Welcome to another episode of Autismable Dance, Life with Autism, from a parent's perspective. With each episode, Rob and I talk with media professionals, business owners, and nonprofits to discuss what they are doing to help families get the services they need and how the public perceives autism. We also talk with other autism parents and autistic individuals about their life and autism. All right, welcome Kimberly Sanders to the Autismable Dads podcast. And today we're going to talk about pretty much what I introduced in the intro about you, you know, dealing with, you know, you being a mom of a multi-diagnosed kid, Lucas, Down syndrome, autism, your book. There's a lot in your book that you just unpackage and share. And folks, you all need the book. You all need the book. You all need to check out this book, Beside You. And let me tell you, it's eye-opening. It's refreshing to me when I was reading it. It's very refreshing. But we're going to talk a little bit about it. So, Kimberly, let's get down to brass tacks here. You had a challenge in your life. You know, you met your husband, you got the diagnosis, you're pregnant, all this stuff coming around. Let's go into the order of events because my brain's getting all Swiss cheese here. Set me straight. The order of events of how Lucas came about.
Sure. You
know, yeah.
Well, he was a long awaited child. I wanted to be a mom for a very long time. And I didn't get pregnant until I was older. And so certainly our doctors were asking whether or not I wanted to do any early diagnosis or amniocentesis. And we decided against it. I really just kept saying, I will love the child God gives me, and went through the pregnancy without any alert or concerns. Nothing was brought up. So it really wasn't until that day of his birth that he, you know, quite quickly after he was born, they sweetly laid him on my chest, and I thought all was well. And I just, you know, delighted in ice chips while there was a lot of activity that was going around the room. And I didn't, it didn't hit me. I think I perhaps should have been a bit aware that something was going on. We had a nurse that asked me if I had had the amniocentesis test. And quickly, I think they pulled my husband aside and gave him a little peek into what they were thinking. They suspected Down syndrome right away, but of course we had to wait for the genetic test. So we knew that night he had they thought he had a detached aorta, which was not true, but they were having a hard time seeing his heart. And they did notice this very common heart situation called the AV canal where the heart doesn't fully form. And so they needed to move him to Children's Hospital in Chicago. And I think really at that point, things were becoming clear that there was something going on, but a bit of a hush, at least.
Right. The trepidation of sharing, we know something's up, we have a feeling it's this, but we're not going to say anything until we have confirmation.
Right. And it's uneasy.
It's frustrating.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't know. You know, I'm so thankful, Joel, that for me, I know a lot of parents in the Down syndrome community are very grateful to get the diagnosis while they're still pregnant because they can prepare and plan. For me, that was not the case. I was so thankful that I got to meet him first and just see his face with kind of a purity to it. And so for me, it was helpful to get the information in morsel bites rather than the whole feast of what was going on. But But I don't think it's easy. And I know a lot of stories of families that have been greatly disheartened by the way they are told or how the medical profession perhaps views this Down syndrome diagnosis, because obviously we didn't get the autism diagnosis till later.
Right. And you know, like I was sharing with you before we started recording, getting that diagnosis can be a challenge even with autism. It was the hesitancy, especially a decade or so ago, of putting a label from the medical community onto a child. There's this huge hesitancy of it. And I mean, what can you do as a parent? I mean, it's you can't take action in any way, shape, or form without having an understanding of what it could be. And then right. You can go, oh, okay, if it is this, then I can take this course of action. But if we have to wait for a diagnosis, we're sitting there twiddling our thumbs, not able to do anything. No action can be taken. Right. And here you are waiting. How long did it wait until they got the diagnosis of Down syndrome?
It was 3 days later. So, my husband's birthday is 3 days after Lucas, and mm-hmm. we found out that the diagnosis was confirmed. And I remember then we went out to so-called celebrate his birthday, and mm-hmm. there's weight. I mean, as you know, the first part, I think, of any diagnosis, it's so wrapped in fear. There's so much uncertainty that it's hard to celebrate in the midst of the fear. And I think in part, we have to embrace the fear and the grief, right? Because once we do that, then we really can get to the joy. But I remember so few details or facts about those first days, but I do remember getting that diagnosis on my husband's birthday, because I just was so aware of the juxtaposition of what felt sorrowful with trying to celebrate. And obviously we should have been really trying to celebrate Lucas too.
Right. There's that aspect of you're in the fear of the unknown. You got this diagnosis, you had to wait for it. So you had the unknown of what it was. You had an idea, mm-hmm. but you really had to wait for confirmation. So there's this unknown yet known. You're kind of in this waiting pool, and right. then all of a sudden it hits you. Happy birthday. Your husband's name was Eric.
Yes.
Yeah. So here's Eric on his birthday as a dad, and he's going, okay, we got this going, and now I'm this old. Great. so you have, it's, that's like, so okay, cool. All right, I'm now a year older, and now I got a kid with special needs. Okay. Right. Now, all right. So what's going on through his head? What's going on through your head, your heart, all this stuff that's going on, all the emotion associated with that. And life goes forward. Life moves forward. And you start trying to, let me guess. I'm just going to guess here. You immediately dive into the aspects of Down syndrome. What support systems do you have? What's available? Right?
Right. Like right.
It's natural.
Right. Well, and the, you know, Mr. Google was partly my friend. You know, I think when you go on to doctor, I think my OBGYN called him, he was like, Dr. Google, stop it. Because I would read so much. And of course, they're trying to give you the full spectrum of all the things that might happen. But in that state of, I think, panic and a bit of trauma, you just assume all of those things are going to happen. So it
oh, felt, yeah.
It felt very overwhelming. And my husband and I really did process it very differently. I was certainly very emotional. And he just was about the pivot, I think he went into more of the problem solving of, All right.
Which is probably the most natural response for any man. Go into problem solving mode. It's what do I need to do? What can I do to fix? What do I need to do? It's very action oriented. I know I was that way. A lot of men are that way. There are some men, and this is for the audience. There are some men that are in denial of any diagnosis. Oh, my kid's perfect. I hate to break it to the men out there. No child is perfect. And the reason I know that is that a child is often the carbon copy of their parents. And I look in the mirror every morning and realize I ain't perfect.
Right.
And sometimes I'm reminded by family and friends, I'm not perfect. So if I'm not perfect, my kid is awesome, but everybody has flaws. Right. So, as I would say with, my friend, Rob, in these scenarios where dads are, you know, sometimes off to the side, in these scenarios, in these situations with a new diagnosis, I often say, suck it up, buttercup. Sometimes it's just being present is the answer.
Right. Well, and I will say, Joel, I so appreciated your piece on grief that you did recently, because for me, it was really helpful to hear that emotional response from the male perspective, that you, that you were willing to talk about that and be vulnerable about that. And that,
well, thank you.
Yes. I appreciate that.
Then I'm going to make the note for that. I'm going to put out more rambling about grief. Hold on,
let me make that. Perfect. Up. I'll give you a list.
Oh, great. Great. Hold on. Let me hide. The challenge, it is a challenge, you know, as dads. We want, you know, there's all this preconceived notion or ideology of us as husbands and fathers of what to expect from our kids. Because we grew up a certain way and we were happy with it or not. And we want the best for our kids. And so we have this expectancy. And when that expectancy is essentially pulled out from under us, we're at a loss. We don't know what to do. And, but yeah, it's a natural response to have that fix it mentality, because it's a grab at straws, and, you know, it's a grab for, like, I need to hold on to something. I need to do something.
Yeah. Well, and I think we somehow expect our children to be these blank canvases that we get to paint upon, right? And do all of the imagining and dreaming. And we forget that they come to us with all of their own qualities already baked in. And so I know, you know, we literally the night before Lucas was born, we were sitting out on a porch talking about how much we wanted to travel. And we were going to, you know, that he would come, or this, we knew he was a boy, that we were having a boy, but that we were going to bring him with us to all these different places. And, you know, there was the dream that just hasn't really been, you know, it's not something that we can do, but.
Right.
But it's new acceptance.
Yeah, we had an opportunity a couple times to take our son to, early on when he was much younger, to the local AAA baseball team here in Norfolk, Virginia, is the Tidewater Tides. And they have a nice stadium that, you know, in downtown Norfolk area. And we took him to the game, and we have a couple of pictures of taking him to the baseball game. That was the only time in his life he's actually been at a baseball game, because the amount of noise and sensory input for everything as he got older, and as the more sensory issues became an issue, we just couldn't anymore.
Right.
The challenges associated with the sensory issues became to where we had to get that under control. We had to mitigate those noises. We had to address those things, and putting on headphones was a no-go. He just wouldn't keep them on. So, you know, all these great events that are in our area, especially for autistic families, we have to be extremely cautious of. It's just too much. It's just too much. And so you share your book about, you know, relishing in the silence or the quietness. of your home at times. Mm-hmm. And I can completely relate having those moments of quiet. I used to play music all the time. I still do every once in a while. And I'm looking over at my stereo here. But the reality of it is like, it's nice to just, there's no noise, no background, no iPad to, you know, on, just quiet.
Quiet.
And it is so nice. It
does. Right. Our children teach us that.
Yeah. And it's just like, okay. And there's peace in the stillness. You know, you don't have to be active 110% of the time. You shared about just being a mom. You go through all this, you know, trying to deal with, you know, all this therapy, trying to push Lucas, trying to deal with all this. And then you come to the realization that it's okay to just, you got to remember to just be a mom.
Right. Yeah. And it was our physical therapist that had said that to me, that, you know, I really felt that everything was homework, that we would learn something. And every time she would come, that in essence, I was going to be graded. How did I do? Did I get him sit, you know, strengthening his core so he could sit up? And I would feel such guilt just sitting and watching Sesame Street or anything with him, because it to me was, wow, that's wasted time. He's already going to be delayed. I need to try to make up that gap. And when she said, just be mom, it felt incredibly freeing, certainly, but disorienting, because I was so much in the striving. And I think Lucas has been so much about teaching me to savor, right?
Right.
And so I had to realize that we are lucky that we have so many people that come alongside our children and help them. And I think that helps give us a bit more permission to just be mom, just be dad.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I learned early on with my son. Dad, I just need you. I don't need all this extra stuff. I just need you to hang out with me.
Right.
You know, so sometimes he'll lay in his bed and I'll just sit beside his bed, you know, knees on the floor, just kneeling on this, you know, on the side. And here's my son, just happy I'm there, just happy I'm present. I don't have to say anything. I'm just there. I have my phone. I'll look through some stuff. My son's on his iPad. And he's like, he is happy, smiling. He's engaged. And he's just happy I'm present. And sometimes that's all he needed or all he needs at that moment. And sometimes, and what he'll tell me, he'll just go that way. And that's just his signal to me. Like, I'm done with you. You can go now.
Right.
and it's like, what? I thought we were having fun. It's like, no, I'm cool. Thanks for hanging out, Dad. I'm good.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Right. And we can get so activity based that we forget that really it's our children want connection. Mm-hmm. And it's a call back to just being connected and to stop inserting all the activity or the working at something, because it certainly can bring connection, right? Like you sitting with your son at a baseball game, there's connection, but sometimes that connection, like you said, just happens in the most simple, mundane moments.
Yeah. It's the little things. It's not the grandiose, broad, hey, we got to go do this great activity, or, right. Oh, you're needing this therapy 6 times a week and I'm there with you for the therapy. No, that's an activity. Right. That's pushing the individual to do a task. Sometimes just hanging out and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes the best moments just to play around and have some fun. You can joke around. I never realized how mischievous and sarcastic my son is until I just sat next to him.
Yeah.
And he does things that are just mischievous. He has a mischievous grin. He has an infectious laugh. When things get really, when he gets really joking about something, he'll just giggle at the funniest word.
Right.
And so you're just like, what? And it's just like, no, that's just, it caught him funny, you know? Yeah. And it's just, and you have no choice but to just chuckle and just go, I'm witnessing a moment where he witnessed something funny. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's interested in. That's what makes him laugh. That's what causes that joy. And here I am just going, okay, what was he laughing at? What, you know? And it could be something mundane on a YouTube video in my mind, but as I look at it, I'll look back at that video sometimes and I'll just go, that's the point where he laughed. And now I get it. I get why he was joking, because at that moment he was looking at me, looking at his mom, and it'll all come back to me at that moment and go, now I know why he was chuckling. And it didn't matter what it was. It's just, I understood. And I think that's intriguing that you came to that realization of from your physical therapist, just be a mom. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Just be a mom, or just be a dad. Just hang out. Just chill. That's right. Cool.
Yes, I agree. So, we need
that. Yeah. And my mind's going to my notes at the moment because there was just so much that I gleaned from your book that I was like, okay, people, you just need this. Get this book. So you're dealing with being a mom, and also, you have this lurking monster of being in the public eye with him and all this other stuff. What was that like? You know, because I know what it's like as a parent of just an autistic kid.
Right.
You know, and, but you're dealing with a multi-diagnosed situation. You didn't even get the autism diagnosis yet, but you have this going out in public scenario. How did you said you were leading like two different lives?
Right. Well, yes. So I think I started to notice the pattern of how much I was delighting in Lucas when we were at home, that everything he did was bringing me a lot of joy. And I was just reveling in any of the small things that he was doing. But then I would get out into a public place and all of a sudden everything felt like not enough. I would watch and think, why aren't you're not doing that like the other kids. And parents would talk about, and again, this would be parents that were raising typically developing children and parents that were raising Down syndrome, children with Down syndrome, that all of a sudden I was really aware of my own inner meter of comparing. And I think comparison always robs us of joy. Mm-hmm. And I had to pretty intentionally reorient myself to say, I will not jump into that arena of comparisons, because one, it will just get me looking for people that can't do as much as Lucas. And I could see how that wasn't kind, right? I'm going to search for the person that can do even less, because that'll make me feel better about my son. Well, that wasn't kind. And I was going to not want to look at the children that could do more than Lucas, because that just pulled some envy out of me. Mm. And I thought that's a very isolating way to live, that I can't look to those that can do more. I can't look to those that can do less. And it really became, I have to celebrate all children.
Right.
So I need to walk into that social setting and continue to celebrate even the small things that Lucas was doing, but really ask myself to engage with all the children. And so that, you know, we want people to love our children. And so I think we have to ask ourselves to do the same, right? To reach out and love all the children around us. So though I remember when Lucas was born, someone did say, well, you know, her children were older. She said, at least you're not going to have all of the striving around. She lived in Chicago, so they had to really apply for the high schools. And she was like, you're not going to have to worry about that or college. And initially I felt very released from all of that, but it snuck its way in anyway. And I started to see that comparisons were still lurking in the corners. And so it's been very freeing to just resolve myself to not compare.
Yeah, I think it's easy, like you said, it's easy to fall into comparing us as parents or kids with other kids. You know, they can do this, they can do that, our kid can't. And so you start focusing on the lack rather than on the strengths. And it's so easy to do that, even to this day. I mean, here we are, you know, our son is an adult now. Okay, what can and can't he do? Well, legally, you have to address those things as a parent. You know, if they're society, you know, they can't function independently in society. Yeah, legally, you have to address some things. But the reality of it is there's a whole lot more strengths in other avenues that they are good at.
Right.
That you have to focus on that. And it's so easy to fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded regularly, especially as I work on Autismable and some of these other sites that I manage to moderate, that each individual needs to be addressed as an individual. You can't put them into this giant group of insanity and say, you're not performing to the best standards. By whose standard?
Right.
You know, and, you know, we have various different aspects of the autism community that, you know, are very vocal. And then you have other aspects of the autism community that are not as vocal.
Right.
But is any one of them less than the other? No. Mm-hmm. You know, they have equal value. It's mm-hmm. just a matter of some require certain help in certain areas and others don't.
Right.
Others require certain help in other areas. So it is so easy to get caught up in that. It sometimes frustrates me because sometimes I have to step in and moderate and go, you do realize that their deficiencies are not yours. And what? You know, as either a parent or an autistic individual. And it's frustrating. Right. But yeah, spot on, I tell you. We're going to take a moment for sponsors. So we're going to take a short little break. Afterwards, we'll dive into IEPs, a little bit about, of course, the autism diagnosis. And I'm curious about your lockdown policy at your house that you shared in your book and some of what your involvement with behavior therapists and the emotional rain dance, all this and more after the break.
Great.
Kimberly Sanders naively imagined motherhood as a serene walk beside her children. However, she discovered it is more often unpredictable, fraught with struggle, and ultimately an invitation to sit beside her children in the muck and mystery. In her first book, Beside You, Kimberly generously shares the unpredictable struggles and rich lessons learned through Lucas, her son who has both Down syndrome and autism. Beside You is already available, and as part of Down Syndrome Awareness Month. Now, we think you might be interested in listening to this particular podcast, as Kimberly is relentlessly hopeful that her story that she shares is uplifting and inspiring to other families facing similar challenges and situations. So join us as we dive into and talk with Kimberly about her journey and talking about her son, Lucas. We hope you enjoy this episode. For those that don't know me or what we are about on Autismable Dads, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Joel Manzer, and, well,
I'm the founder and lead editor of Autismable.com. Autismable is a site where, well, anyone can join, share, and connect with others in the autism community. You probably didn't know this, but your favorite autism bloggers are most likely on Autismable, along with several autistic individuals and organizations that are also a part of Autismable. And we'd love to have you join in as well. To learn more about autism from parents, professionals, nonprofits, and more importantly, from those who are autistic. Now, I'm just one neurotypical autism dad, learning more about autism, primarily so I can learn more about who my son is. Why would you want to join? That's up to you. Anyways, join me on Autismable.com. I look forward to meeting you. Okay. Welcome back, folks. If you stuck around this far, more compelling as we move forward. And as I sip more coffee, yay.
Yes.
Must have coffee. Coffee flows.
We need it.
So with your educational background, and you had colleagues talking to you about addressing IEPs. Now, you were in IEP meetings as an instructor, as a teacher.
Right.
Now, lo and behold, the tables have turned.
Yes.
And here you are on the flip side of it, trying to address an IEP as a parent. Mm-hmm. Now, what were the differences that you found most compelling between being a teacher now flipped into being a parent? What are like top three items? One you mentioned was the power of we.
Right. So as a teacher, you go into that meeting hoping to be able to create some goals that feel that they will serve the child, that it will be doable on your end, something that you can really agree is possible. And I think you're always looking to the tone. I found myself very, very tuned into the tone of the parent and watchful for the parent that was really wanting to create a team there versus a bit didactic, like we want this, do this, we need this. And so the tone really, I thought, was key to how we moved forward as an educational team. So you would think that as a former teacher going into an IEP meeting that I would be very helped. But I didn't find that to be true as a parent at all. I felt that I couldn't live solely in my one role, that I was constantly questioning, how are the teachers seeing this? How is my tone? Am I making sure that I'm not being too demanding? And yet there were things as a parent that I knew we wanted for Lucas. And I didn't want to get into the, in essence, the people pleasing of the teachers over my child. Like I have to please my child, not the teachers. But I had been given the advice by a colleague when I was getting ready to go into this particular meeting for Lucas. I said, what advice would you give me? And she was the head of the special ed department in a high school. And she said, I will tell you that I so often want to kick the parents underneath the table and say, ask for more. And so we did. We went into this meeting thinking, okay, that's it. We want to have these high expectations. We want to ask and somehow garner as much help for Lucas as possible.
Right.
And we want to keep this we want to keep the tone and the team mentality possible. And I think that tension is something that we all have to reckon with when we go into IEP meetings. Because in essence, we're really not, we have to walk being on both sides. We're on both teams, right? So the minute we go solely to our child, I think we leave the educators behind and we're not including them, and they're the ones that are going to help our child in those settings. And then if we go too much with the educators, we may not be speaking up for our children right?
Right.
We
you're
the voice for the voiceless.
Right. You're trying to be that bridge.
Right.
Right. Right. The I've shared this before in previous episodes of the podcast. In our situation, my wife took point with IEP meetings, being the essential CEO of the team, of saying, okay, we need to do this. We need to do that. Where are we? Where are we with this?
Right.
And then just going, okay, well, then we need, you know, taking the advice of the educators and saying, okay, so we're going to do this, right? Oh, okay. All right. And it's just, it became, after several years, it became by rote. She knew what to do and we had a great team and it wasn't a major issue. It's interesting to note that here you are coming from a teacher's perspective, now on a parent's perspective, dealing with that. And the question that comes to my mind, because I've talked to other parents who were teachers, going to the flip side, there was also a concern about if I'm too harsh in this environment, will that potentially impact my job in some way? Did you ever find or feel that way in some extent?
As a teacher? That if I'm too hard, that it would impact my job?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, you know, I don't know. No, I wouldn't say that. I don't think I did feel that way. I was very aware. We were, particularly at one of the schools I worked at, we were very clear that in essence, our bosses were the parents, right? They were the taxpayers. They were, and so we knew that they were key for us to build a really strong relationship with.
Okay.
No, I didn't feel, I wouldn't say I felt threatened.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the concern about that is there have been some couples that I've spoken with that, you know, the husband was really knowledgeable in the special education realm and said, we needed to do this and this and this. And his wife was also a teacher and was worried about potential repercussions of certain demands because the IEPs were not met. And so certain things would happen that have to happen. And so there's always this concern, and you mentioned about kind of always being that people pleaser type of thing, you know, that does happen in the education field. But it's good to know.
Right. And I do think, Joel, that we've at least moved more toward trying to have as many of those conversations one-on-one with the various teachers prior to the IEP, because we just don't want to have the surprises. And I think you can have sometimes more nuanced and intimate conversations one-on-one with the teacher, as opposed to in that forum where maybe it would feel like you're putting the teacher on the spot.
Right.
You know, in front of everybody, but if you have it alone, it could be, you know, we're concerned. We're not sure he's getting enough fill in the blank.
Right. Okay, right.
You know, et cetera.
Right. So that makes sense.
That's been helpful for us.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think those are some good notes for other people to also take into consideration is the ongoing communication with the teacher and saying what's going on here, what's happening, does help. I know for us, we still require our son's teacher to write in a communication log because that's the only information we get, you know, about how he's performing in school, what's happening. Did he sleep? Because he didn't sleep well last night. Did he sleep during school today? Stuff like that, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, that explains why he was this way at school, you know, or when he got off the bus. Yeah, that's just some good stuff. So you're dealing with all that, then you get into the autism diagnosis. How did that come about?
Oh, you know,
big deep sigh. Here you are, Down syndrome, dealing with a kid with Down syndrome, then all of a sudden you're like, something ain't right here. What's going on? And then autism. Did you know? Did you have ideas?
No, not at all. And I would say, I think it's really tricky with this dual diagnosis because so many of the behaviors are similar. So it wasn't like we were seeing behaviors that weren't a part of a child that has Down syndrome. We were seeing the sensory issues, but though, you know, I think of it as a Venn diagram. Like so many of the behaviors are in that center place, sensory, the sleep, the wanting thing, the repetition and wanting things to feel more known and transition. So all of that, anytime we would see a behavior, we just kind of naturally assumed it was because of him having Down syndrome. It wasn't until we had a woman that we were working with who was a therapist, and she said, I think you need to get him tested. And she, the specific behavior she pointed to was the flapping of his arms. Mm-hmm. And initially I thought, no, I can't bear another label. I didn't want the overwhelm. I didn't want that for him. But we eventually brought him in, and the neurologist observed him, and we came back in, and I asked quite pointedly that, you know, do you see that he's on the spectrum? And he said, yes. And of course all the anxiety kind of rose up. And then he said, but I think we all are. We all fall on the spectrum somewhere. And so I took the answer I wanted, and I was like, oh, okay, then he doesn't have it. Okay, then. And I think Lucas was 5. And it wasn't until he was 8 where yet again we had a therapist that said, I think there's something else also going on. She didn't know if it was OCD, if it was autism. She didn't know, but she was starting to see more behaviors that were leading her to question that. And it was interesting for me within that 3-year time frame to watch how I went from desperately not wanting to have this additional diagnosis to realizing that isn't it really that we just want to know our children fully? Right. I want to know Lucas in all of who he is and as fully as I possibly can. And so I was starting to see that understanding these behaviors, and if there was a name for it, like autism, then that was going to help me know him better. And then truly it was just, I had another friend she has 4 daughters, 2 of which have Down syndrome, but her youngest presented differently. And she said it was only because she had an older daughter with Down syndrome that she was able to see something else was going on with her younger daughter. And when I talked to her, she was the one that just said, you think this label is going to hurt you or hurt your son? And she said, I really want you to know he will be the same kid, pre-label, post-label. He's Lucas, that's who he is. But this label will help you. You will start to get the service. He will get the services that he needs. He can start to grow in ways that he's not able to right now. And so I literally went into that particular meeting hoping that he was going to get the diagnosis.
Right, right. It's a lot like what you and I shared earlier, and even before we started recording this episode, that, you know, in our situation, it took several years to get that label, that diagnosis.
Yeah.
But having it wasn't just a door opening. It was a floodgates of information. It was a floodgate of services that were just allowed to us, so we can be able to go, okay, we know what's going on with him. We know what's happening. Now we know how to work with him. Now we know, on one hand, we don't want the labels.
Right.
But on the other hand, you have to have it. And from a medical standpoint, or from a diagnosis standpoint, you have to have it for insurance purposes. You have to have it for levels of services that you can be able to obtain in order to help your kid be the best that they can be.
Right.
And it's one of those, you know, do I get it? What's the harm in having it? It's a social construct that labels are bad.
Mm-hmm. Or limiting. The reason we don't want it is we don't want someone to meet our child and think that they know our child just because they know the label. Right.
Oh, yeah. It's like, oh, your kid's autistic. What's it? Is he good at math?
Right. So now what? I know him. Right.
What? No, he's not the good doctor. No, he's a teenage kid that just is, he's nonverbal and he's sarcastic just like his dad. I mean, come on. Really?
Right.
So yeah, no, I completely get it. It's that struggle of you go from not wanting that label to, yeah, I need it. I need to have it. So it opened a lot of opportunities for you. And
I will say too, I speak, I guess, for the other families out there that may fall prey to what happened to me, but I had such a narrow understanding of autism. To me, the signs were, you know, not much eye contact, somebody that doesn't want to socially engage as much or is comfortable with affection. And here I have a child who is very much about affection and wants, I mean, very social. And so again, because I had such a narrow understanding of autism, I didn't even, when I was seeing other things present in my son, I wasn't allowing myself to also see that.
Yeah. It's an eye-opening experience when we discovered, we had an inkling, we had an idea that our son's autistic.
Yeah.
But it's the, oh yeah, well, you know, you use the phrase in Down syndrome, you know, with your friend that had two daughters, it didn't present itself in one way as it did in another, you know, in one person as it did in another. And the same holds true, I find, for autism. You know, autism presents in my son in certain ways, and it presents in another person who's autistic in different ways.
Right.
And I know with our son, oh, he loves hugs. He's a hugger. He loves eye contact. He loves a smile. He loves all that there is present. He's like any other teenager, any other kid.
Yeah.
But the, you know, there's assumptions based upon what has been proliferated about autism in general. That it's like, no, this is my kid. He's crazy kid, just like any other parent's crazy kid.
That's right.
I'm going to shift gears just for a moment, because I was reading a chapter of yours in your book that talked about how you lock everything down. You know, the electronics are put away. Mm-hmm. All this stuff is locked down. I'm curious, and I didn't really understand why, because I was trying to read through fast. I'll be honest. I was trying to read through your book fast, because I just wanted to leave it open for you to discuss most of the time. So why do you have this lockdown in place?
Well, so I guess I'll kind of work from the outside in. We have, mm-hmm. we have alarms on the doors. We have locks on the doors, because his favorite game is, can he escape? And so that fancy word of eloping or running away, he has done that numerous times, and it's given us opportunities to meet our local police officers, as we had to go in search of him. Matter of fact, in the book, I tell the story of, we had just moved into the home we live in now, and I was, you know, I wasn't familiar yet with all the sounds, and I heard a bang, but the kids at that time were finding it really fun to use Eric's guitar case as a balance beam. And so they would walk on it. So I just thought they had knocked it down and were going to play with it, much to his chagrin. But all of a sudden I realized that I had my daughter out running the street, meeting our new neighbors in footies, and Lucas was completely nude. And then there I am running out. So we knew kind of quickly we were going to need some help with.
Hello, neighbors.
We have the best neighbors, but I will tell you, it was not the best start. but then we've had other things where he once put my Nook in our microwave and turned it on, and it was an early morning, and I'm smelling this rubbery smell. I can't imagine what's going on. And only to find that there's this fire in the microwave. So now we have latches on the microwave. He loves ice cream. And if we leave the ice cream in the freezer unlocked, he will just eat it until it's gone. And so we have to put things around the refrigerator to keep him from.
Yeah, you were describing what you called, or what was called in your book, an emotional rain dance. It's something that that Lucas feeds off of, is the is those emotional rides that often those emotional responses that we have, or reactions that we have,
right,
in situations. So this is one of those reasons why you keep things locked down. You keep things in a little bit more in control, and you have to address your emotions that way too, right?
Oh, absolutely. So that, you know, I have a theater background, so I think everything for me feels like my responses can often be rather perhaps theatrical or big. And that just is going to encourage him to do it more and more.
Oh, okay.
So I have to take a lot of, so going back to the microwave, of course I had a huge, loud response to that, which for him, he just thought that was funny. And that's just going to encourage him to want to do it again. So I find I have to really temper my responses to, you know, if he grabs a knife, of course I want to scream, but I have to, okay, here, Lucas, thank you, I'll take that, to keep him from seeing a negative behavior as something that will elicit a really fun response.
Right.
Even when
I mean, that can be quite disconcerting. I know you raise your voice as a parent, kids, whether they're special needs or not, they will have a response to that.
Yeah.
My voice carries big time. It carries. So if I raise my voice, the house shakes. I'm that dad, you know, and it's not because I want to, it's because it just happens to be that way. And sometimes we have great neighbors as well. Our neighbors are awesome. You know, it's great being a special needs family with a bunch of neighbors that understand, or at least have an understanding of what's going on in your dynamic, because sometimes we've had neighbors that have actually stopped vehicles of people. My son had a meltdown in our backyard. Well, some people saw that across the way, and they would get in their pickup truck, come around, and, you know, try to defend, you know, come and run in support of someone and defending. Well, you know, we had a neighbor that just said, hold up, what's going on? And they're like, well, somebody's beating up on somebody. No, here's what's going on. It's an autism family. Their son's probably having a meltdown. Just give it a few minutes and chill. And it's like, where else would you find that? You know, it's when you have awesome neighbors like that, that stick up for you, that defend you, that are understanding of you, in your situation, it becomes part of a safety net, you are very grateful and appreciative of those moments. And it's those types of situations where you just have to sit back and go, okay. Now it's been a while since that's happened, but yeah, it's nice. It's nice.
Right.
I don't want anybody else getting involved in our situation. Let the meltdown happen. He'll get over it. And you know, just let him process, get him calmed down, and he'll be all right. If I have any bruises, I'll heal. I'll be all right. it's, you know, kids will be kids. Meltdown's a meltdown.
It's difficult in those public settings, because when we aren't maybe raising our voice to stop our child from doing something that maybe looks like really bad behavior, we can often feel like these onlooking eyes are questioning our parenting. Like, why aren't you stopping yourself from doing this? And why aren't you, or even this, we have we learned the term planned ignoring, that, okay, we know Lucas does a certain behavior, we're going to ignore it, but we can be, whether it's at a family house or friends, or again, just in a more general social setting, it feels negligent to ignore it. in front of other people. And yet that is, again, I think it's like, who are we going to try to honor the most in the moment? Is it going to be our child? And so we will ignore it or not respond so much emotionally to a behavior, or are we going to try to be honoring strangers even?
Yeah. It's
going to avoid the glare.
Yeah. It's I'm 6'4" and over 300 pounds. I'm not happy about my weight, but I can't help the height. And with a big booming voice, I come across as pretty intimidating to begin with, just, you know, sheer size and stuff. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that just me speaking loudly can come across as very rude to some people, just loudly. I don't, you know, it's not intentional. I'm not trying to be mean or anything, but sometimes, you know, if somebody's across the way in a shopping situation, I have to bring something to somebody's attention, I raise my voice a little. And that catches a lot of people's attention. And I shared a long time ago about a story where we have a local supermarket that's now no longer around. They went bankrupt. But I took my son there to shop. He was young. And we're in line, as you know, I could probably start a whole nother website calling Standing in Line. And he's sitting in the shopping cart and he's counting the numbers of the aisles of the checkout lines, you know, the checkout aisles. He's going one, he's just counting. Mm-hmm. And there's this couple in front of us. And she's just starting to harp on the cashier. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to buy alcohol with essentially food stamps, for lack of a better phrase. And of course you can't do that. And the cashier's, you know, saying, I'm sorry, ma'am, you can't do that. So this one lady is just starting to raise your voice more and raise your voice more. And the guy that's between her and me is her boyfriend, I assume. And he pulls out of his pocket this roll of cash, this large roll of cash. And I'm just thinking to myself, oh, great. All right. And he was going to buy some stuff separately from her, but they're together. It's very obvious. And Jonathan's starting to feed. He mimics a lot of the attitudes and actions that's going around him. So he's starting to get upset and he gets louder and he's starting to distim more and he's starting to say the numbers of the aisles more. And he's starting to just mimic that attitude. And she turns around and looks at me and looks at him and looks back at me and says, will you shut him up? Now, mind you, I don't think she realized who she's reckoning with. I'm an autism dad with lack of sleep and highly caffeinated and full of attitude myself. So all I said was, in a very loud, stern voice, my son's autistic. What's your problem? Mm. And that's all I said. But I said it in such a way you could hear a pin drop mm-hmm. when I was done. And you'd have beep, beep of all of these registers happening. You'd have all the activity of all these other lines going, you know, lines going. The manager came by, talked to the cashier and asked me if there's anything wrong. And I said, your cashier is awesome and doing phenomenal work and trying her best, but she's trying to purchase alcohol with food stamps. And I left it at that.
Yeah.
And this one lady was huffing and puffing. She just told her boyfriend, pay for it. I'm out. I'll meet you at the car. And she said she had enough. Mm-hmm. And the boyfriend looked at me and said, why are you done doing that? And I said, don't mess with the parent and their kid. Move on. I didn't even mention, you know, again, about, you know, our son being autistic. I said, just, you don't say that to a parent about their kid. You just don't.
Right.
You don't harp on a parent about their kid that way. You just don't. It doesn't matter if they're special needs or not. You just don't.
Right.
And he's like, oh, you know, he kind of huff and puff, paid for it, moved on. But it's that I want it my way or the highway attitude. And if you don't act a certain way,
mm-hmm.
we're gonna talk down to you because you're not quote unquote normal.
Right.
And I love, there's one autism parent that really made this phrase very, very prevalent. Normal is just a setting on a dryer.
Yeah.
I love that phrase.
Agree.
It's awesome. So to define normal.
Yeah.
Please, somebody. There's a phrase that you share in your book, and I had to write it down, and I think I'm going to stick it up here. It's you can read my handwriting here. It's crud. Our needs are not an occasion to escape other people, but an opportunity to engage other people. Our fears.
Our needs. So, and that comes from one of the chapters where we were in a music class and both of my kids were starting to become a bit difficult. Lucas is running and grabbing a man's hat and phones, and my daughter's running over to the guitar to strum it when we were told by the teacher to not touch it. And I was so aware of how I wasn't enough for the situation, where I was feeling very inadequate as a mom and that I needed extra help. And I just remember internally berating my need. And it was, I think, on the car ride home even, where I realized, wow, I want Lucas to embrace his needs. I want him to celebrate that he gets other people to come around him and give him help. But if I can't understand or accept my own needs, how am I ever going to be able to teach him to accept and celebrate his needs?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where that phrase comes from, right?
I like that phrase. It reminded me that, you know, it goes back to the thought process of fight or flight.
Mm.
And often in these situations, you have to, the phrase lean in.
Yeah.
Your phrase right there, that saying, just reminded me, Joel, you need to lean in a bit on this situation. You need to lean in, you need to lean in to listen, you need to lean in to be open to expression. You need to lean into these things. And I was like, yeah, it's a powerful statement.
Well, thank you.
That's just powerful. I'm gonna pause there for just a self-reflective moment.
Sure.
There was another situation where you're dealing with, you know, the phrase, how somebody said it compared to how you heard it. And I think this is a very compelling type thing, because sometimes when people tell us something, they're saying something with good intention, but we hear it completely different. And somebody said to you, wow, you have your hands full.
Yeah.
And then it's like, but you heard it differently.
Well, I heard that was a phrase I was hearing a lot, and I heard it as I heard it as a judgment on Lucas, like he's just too much, or that I heard it as a statement of pity, like you have it, so glad I'm not in your shoes, you have it so bad, what a handful. And right. Here I was. Again, I'm somebody so grateful to be a mom and grateful to have my hands full, right? I had a child in each hand, but I did have to, go back to the goodness of people's motivation, that we can all say things that can be misinterpreted or heard other than how we mean it. But I do think now when I hear that, because I still hear it, it'll be weird perhaps after people read the book if no one says handful to me anymore. Now I hear it from a heart of perhaps compassion or graciousness. And now I might even be more inclined to say, I do. You want to help? Grab a child for me, would you?
Could you run an errand for me, please? Yeah, I have my hands full.
That's right.
It's like, I got so much on my honey-do list right now. Dude, help me out. Can you?
That's right.
Yeah, my hands are full. Come on, man. Help a brother out. I mean, seriously. I had to say that to a buddy of mine. And he was like, Joel, you got your hands full. And I'm like, yeah, I do. He's like, you need help? I'm like, anytime. Come on over.
Good for you.
What? And I said, yeah, anytime. Come on over. If somebody offered help to me, I'm like, yeah, come on over. I will put you to work. I have plenty to do around my house. Absolutely. But there are some of my friends, I'm like, yeah, you ain't going to do that carpentry work. I'm sorry. I've seen you hammer a nail. sorry, folks. I just went on a complete rabbit chase there. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to, what I got from that is, even, I don't care who you are, mom, dad, it's easy to take a well-intentioned phrase and look at the negative side of it.
Right.
And it's so easy. Now, there was an organization that you're a part of that I've never heard of before, MOPS.
Oh, well, yeah. So I was, the book starts with us living in the Chicagoland area, and mm-hmm. then we moved 5 years ago. So we're now in the Southwest Florida area, and I'm sure they have some of that here as well. I was a part of that when I was back in Chicago.
What is MOPS, just for our listeners?
Good question. Let's see if I remember. moms of preschool age children, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's an opportunity for moms to be able to get together, especially when you're feeling pretty isolated because you're in the home nursing or just giving naps. Okay. So I was part of that here, and we are also involved with Gigi's Playhouse, which was started back in Chicago area, but now is all over the country. And that's for children with Down syndrome. We get introduced and make our connections with different families that have children with autism through our behavior therapy and ABA school. So yes, it's so important to find ways to have
got a network.
Absolutely. Thank you for podcasts like you, because I think that's also where I found so much solace, is in when you are by yourself and you can't get out to do the networking. A podcast gives us, or a book gives us, that opportunity to do it in our car, in our home. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Autismable has been around, and it's kind of a social networking site in and of itself. And it's that aspect. That's why Facebook groups dealing with autism are so prevalent. Because you have that type of feel, that look, that, hey, I'm not alone situation. Hey, can you guys tell me about, is this normal for an autistic kid? It's a very common thing. Throughout your book, there's tones and stuff that I really like, aspect of it. For those that aren't aware, congratulations, you're now going to be made aware. Faith has always been a very important part of my life. Somebody's personal faith. It's not something that I express immensely, because I try to keep a very neutral tone in regards to all things autismable, allowing people to express whatever they choose in their faith. Now, your Christian faith is very much a part and ingrained in this book, and it's also helped provide some level of solace for you and your husband and your family. Absolutely. And so what has helped you in that, in, you know, through your faith, in helping you navigate some of these challenges that you've had to deal with over the years?
Yeah, I guess because there's so much unknown and mystery around Lucas, who is only, you know, he has some verbal ability, but in a large part, it's hard to sometimes get into his heart and thoughts. And so I like that it has pushed me to go to God and say, what am I not seeing here? What if I can't know it in this tangible world, can you help me spiritually in the spiritual world to understand what do I need to see that I'm not seeing? What do I need to learn from this? Because I think so many lessons, if we just allow them to stop within the day-to-day life, they can feel discouraging, or that we're living in a place of defeat. Like, we can't do it, he can't do it. And I have found that my faith allows me to perhaps just get to an aerial view of what might be going on. I think the other thing that, so the title Beside You was really getting at, it's been this journey of how I've had to come alongside Lucas and how he has been beside me and stretching me as a parent, but it's also how Jesus has come along beside me, and then ultimately how I want to come alongside other families. But there's one moment, Joel, that I think if I had to point to one moment of where faith really informed me was looking at the scene of Jesus carrying the cross. And it's this idea that, oh, look what he has done, you know, for us, and he, as if he did it all by himself. And I'm not a theologian, so I'm not here to argue that necessarily, but it's that when I reread that scene and I saw that Simon, and was reminded that Simon came and helped Jesus carry the cross. It to me was like, oh my gosh, that God wants us to know that we don't carry any burden alone.
Right.
That we were created to share the burdens and the hardships and the difficulties and the joys and all of it together. And yeah, so
it's a collaborative experience and a relationship experience. It's the fact that you and I are talking right now. It's that we're sharing our experiences in the hope that someone listening can be able to go, you know what? I get it. I'm right there with you. I get it. And because I'm listening to you talk and I'm going, I have lived those moments. we've been through this trial together as parents. Yeah. And the fact that you're dealing with a multi-diagnosed kid, so what? You know, right. I have too. Okay. Where are the commonalities? What's happening? But we've discovered through this episode, this podcast, that you and I, as parents, your husband, my wife, we all have lived through the diagnosis, the challenges associated with certain things in special needs life. And it's like, hey, here's my sister, you know, and she's gone through some things and some amazing stuff that you shared in this awesome book, Beside You by Kimberly Sanders. So where can we find you online? And where is your book located that we can get copies of it? And I do have another question. We're looking at potentially a giveaway of your book.
Sure.
So we'll see about that, and I'll share that online as well, and see what we can do about that, because this is, if I'm not mistaken, October is Down Syndrome Awareness Month, correct?
Correct. So it launched in tomorrow, yes.
Yep. So we'll have some fun sharing that and expressing that. I'm glad that you have been able to share with us your story, your journey, and about your book, Beside You. So where online can we find you?
Your book and everything. I have a website, which is KimberlyLSanders.com. And then I have a Twitter, or no, I do not do Twitter. I barely do Instagram. My Instagram is, the handle is Kimberly L Sanders as well. On the website, you can click directly to where it's being sold, but you can go on your own to Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Booklogix is the publishing house that's carrying it. And yes, you know, on the Instagram, I do share that the front cover is actually a picture of Lucas. It was taken, and then they just kind of, the art design altered it a bit. But I share that only because even my stepdaughter, who just received a book, said, oh my gosh, she didn't even know that that was Lucas. And I think it makes it more personal.
I had a feeling that was, and when the art departments kind of get to it, they go, we're going to have some fun with this. And then they just slap a bunch of different colors on it, morph it.
That's right.
And it's always fun when you're dealing with artists and stuff. I know that from my experience dealing with digital marketing, it's always fun dealing with artists and stuff. Make this, but make it different, new and fresh. And then they put their own spin on it and you're going, what is this? That's cool.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm excited for you. I'm so happy that you're sharing your story and doing this. And I look forward to talking with you again. I'd love to chat with you and your husband again and even get his take on from his perspective, if he's open to that. Because I'm all about annoying the dads too. So,
I think I love it. I love that you are stepping into all of this as a dad. I think we not only our husbands and dads need to hear all that you have to say, but again, like I said earlier, it's really helpful as a woman to hear that point of view as well. So thank you for having me on and for helping support the launch of the book.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And folks, go to KimberlyLSanders.com, get your copy of Besides You, and more later on the next episode. I appreciate our guest for answering several questions, and it's always a joy to talk with other people who have such an interest in the subject of autism. If you'd like to continue this discussion, please feel free to join Autismable.com and share them. You can also follow us via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. As a reminder, this podcast is available on Spotify, Google Play Music, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, and many others. Don't forget to rate, comment, and subscribe. Until next time, I'm your host, Joel Manzer, and thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of Autismable Dads, Life with Autism from a Parent's Perspective. This week's podcast was made possible due to our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to help support this podcast and our efforts with Autismable, please consider becoming a patron. A special thank you to the following top supporters for this week's episode, to John, Daryl, and Linda. Thank you very much for your support.